some arrows with suction cup tips, a baseball bat with its handle wrapped in friction tape, a green hula hoop, but the Daisy air rifle was missing. Harry had taken it inside. He meant to bring it when he went out trick-or-treating as Buffalo Bob. Had Tugga given him shit about that yet? Had his mother already said, "You take it if you want to, it's not a real gun"? If not, they would. Their lines had already been written. My stomach cramped, this time not from the 24-hour bug that was going around, but because total realization, the kind you feel in your gut, had finally arrived in all its bald-ass glory. This was actually going to happen. In fact, it was happening already. The show had started. I glanced at my watch. It seemed to me that I'd left the car in the church parking lot an hour ago, but it was only 5:45. In the Dunning house, the family would be sitting down to supper, although if I knew kids, the younger ones would be too excited to eat much, and Ellen would already be wearing her Princess Summerfall winter-spring outfit. She probably jumped into it as soon as she got home from school and would be driving her mother crazy with requests to help her put on her war paint. I sat down with my back propped against the rear wall of the garage, rummaged in my bag, and brought out a payday. I held it up and considered poor old J. Alfred Prufrock. I wasn't so different, although it was a candy bar I wasn't sure I dared to eat. On the other hand, I had a lot to do in the next 3 hours or so, and my stomach was a rumbling hollow. Fuck it, I thought, and unwrapped the candy bar. It was wonderful. Sweet, salty, and chewy. I gobbled most of it in 2 bites. I was getting ready to pop the rest of it into my mouth and wondering why in God's name I hadn't packed a sandwich and a bottle of Coke when I saw movement from the corner of my left eye. I started to turn, reaching into the bag for the gun at the same time. But I was too late. Something cold and sharp pricked the hollow of my left temple. "Take your hand out of that bag." I knew the voice at once. "Should hope to smile and kiss a pig," its owner had said when I asked if he or any of his friends knew a fellow named Dunning. He had said Derry was full of Dunnings, and I verified that for myself not long after. But he'd had a good idea which one I was after right from the get-go, hadn't he? And this was the proof. The point of the blade dug a little deeper, and I felt a trickle of blood run down the side of my face. It was warm against my chilly skin, almost hot. "Take it out now, chum. I think I know what's in there. And if your hand don't come out empty, your Halloween treat's gonna be 18 inches of Jap steel. This thing's plenty sharp. It'll pop right out the other side of your head." I took my hand out of the bag, empty, and turned to look at no suspenders. His hair tumbled over his ears and forehead in greasy locks. His dark eyes swam in his pale, stubbly face. I felt dismay. So great it was almost despair. Almost, but not quite. "Even if it kills me," I thought again. "Even if." "There's nothing in the bag but candy bars," I said mildly. "If you want one, Mr. Turkett, all you have to do is ask. I'll give you one." He snatched the bag before I could reach in. He used the hand that wasn't holding the weapon, which turned out to be a bayonet. I don't know if it was Japanese or not, but from the way it gleamed in the fading dusk light, I was willing to stipulate that it was plenty sharp. He rummaged and brought out my police special. "Nothing but candy bars, huh? This don't look like candy to me, Mr. Amberson." "I need that." "Yeah, and people in hell need ice water, but they don't get it." "Keep your voice down," I said. He put my gun in his belt, exactly where I had imagined I'd put it once I'd shoved through the hedge and into the Dunning backyard, then poked the bayonet toward my eyes. It took willpower to keep from flinching back. "Don't you tell me what to—" He staggered on his feet. He rubbed first his stomach, then his chest, then the stubble-rough column of his neck, as if something were caught in there. I heard a click in his throat as he swallowed. "Mr. Turkett, are you all right?" "How do you know my name?" And then, without waiting for an answer, "It was Pete, wasn't it? The bartender and the sleepy, he told you." "Yes." "Now, I've got a question for you. How long have you been following me, and why?" He grinned humorlessly, revealing a pair of missing teeth.
"That's two questions."
"Just answer them."
"You act like..."
He winced again, swallowed again, and leaned against the back wall of the garage.
"Like you're the one in charge."
I gauged Turkett's pallor and distress. Mr. Keene might be a bastard with a streak of sadism, but I thought that as a diagnostician, he wasn't too bad. After all, who's more apt to know what's going around than the local druggist? I was pretty sure I wasn't going to need the rest of the kaopectate, but Bill Turkett might. Not to mention the continence pants once that bug really went to work. This could be very good or very bad, I thought. But that was bullshit. There was nothing good about it. Never mind, keep him talking, and once the puking starts, assuming it does before he cuts my throat or shoots me with my own gun, jump him. "Just tell me," I said. "I think I have a right to know since I haven't done anything to you." "It's him you mean to do something to, that's what I think. All that real estate stuff you've been spouting around town, so much crap. You came here looking for him." He nodded in the direction of the house on the other side of the hedge. "I knew it the minute his name jumped out of your mouth." "How could you? This town is full of Dunnings. You said so yourself."
"Yeah, but only one I care about."
He raised the hand holding the bayonet and wiped sweat off his brow with his sleeve. I think I could have taken him right then. But I was afraid the sound of a scuffle might attract attention, and if the gun went off, I'd probably be the one to take the bullet. Also, I was curious. He must have done you a hell of a good turn somewhere along the way to turn you into his guardian angel, I said. He voiced a humorless yap of a laugh.
"That's a hot one, bub. But in a way it's true, I guess I am sort of his guardian angel. At least for now."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean he's mine, Amberson. That son of a bitch killed my little sister. And if anyone puts a bullet in him, or a blade..."
He brandished the bayonet in front of his pale, grim face.
"It's gonna be me."
I stared at him with my mouth open. Somewhere in the distance there was a rattle of pops as some Halloween miscreant set off a string of firecrackers. Kids were shouting their way up and down Witcham Street, but here, it was just the two of us. Christy and her fellow alcoholics called themselves the friends of Bill. We were the enemies of Frank. A perfect team, you would say, except Bill No Suspenders Turkett didn't look like much of a team player.
"You..."
I stopped and shook my head.
"Tell me. If you're half as bright as you think you are, you should be able to put it together for yourself. Or didn't Chazzy tell you enough?"
At first that didn't compute. Then it did. The little man with the mermaid on his forearm and the cheerful chipmunk face. Only that face hadn't looked so cheerful when Frank Dunning had clapped him on the back and told him to keep his nose clean because it was too long to get dirty. Before that, while Frank was still telling jokes at the Tracker Brothers bullshit table at the back of the lamplighter, Chaz Fratty had filled me in about Dunning's bad temper, which, thanks to the janitor's essay, was no news to me. "He got a girl pregnant. After a year or two, she collected the baby and scrammed."
"Is something coming through on the radio waves, Commander Cody?" "Looks like it might be."
"Frank Dunning's first wife was your sister."
"Well, there. The man says the secret word and wins $100.
Mr. Fratty said she took the baby and ran out on him, because she got enough of him turning ugly when he drank."
"Yeah, that's what he told you, and that's what most people in town believe. What Chazzy believes, for all I know, but I know better.
Clara and me was always close. Growing up, it was me for her and her for me. You probably don't know about a thing like that. You strike me as a mighty cold fish, but that's how it was. I thought about that one good year I'd had with Christy, 6 months before the marriage and 6 months after. Not that cold. I know what you're talking about. He was rubbing at himself again, although I don't think he was aware of it. Belly to chest, chest to throat, back down to the chest again. His face was paler than ever. I wonder what he'd had for lunch, but didn't think I'd have to wonder for long. Soon I'd be able to see for myself. Yeah? Then maybe you'd think it's a little funny that she never wrote me after her and Mikey got settled somewhere. Not so much as a postcard. Me, I think it's a lot more than funny, because she woulda. She knew how I felt about her, and she knew how much I loved that kiddo. She was 20, and Mikey was 16 months old when that joke-telling cuntwipe reported him missing. That was the summer of 38. She'd be 40 now, and my nephew'd be 21. Old enough to fucking vote. And you want to tell me she'd never write a single line to the brother who kept Nosy Royce from sticking his wrinkled old meat inside her back when we was kids? Or to ask for a little money to help her get set up in Boston or New Haven or wherever? Mister, I would have... He winced, made a little irk-ulp sound I was very familiar with, and staggered back against the garage wall. You need to sit down, I said. You're sick. I never get sick. I ain't even had a cold since I was in sixth grade. If so, that bug would blitzkrieg him like the Germans rolling into Warsaw. It's stomach flu, Turkett. I was up all night with it. Mr. Keene at the drugstore says it's going around. That narrow ass old lady don't know nothing. I'm fine. He gave his greasy clumps of hair a toss to show me how fine he was. His face was paler than ever. The hand holding the Japanese bayonet was shaking the way mine had until noon today. Do you want to hear this or not? Sure. I snuck a glance at my watch. It was 6:10. The time that had been dragging so slowly was now speeding up. Where was Frank Dunning right now? Still at the market? I thought not. I thought he'd left early today, maybe saying he was going to take his kids trick-or-treating, only that wasn't the plan. He was in a bar somewhere, and not the Lamplighter. That was where he went for a single beer, two at the most, which he could handle, although, if my wife was a fair example, and I thought she was, he would always leave dry-mouthed with his brain raging for more. No, when he felt the need to really take a bath in the stuff, he'd want to do it in one of Derry's down-and-dirty bars, the Spoke, the Sleepy, the Bucket. Maybe even one of the absolute dives that hung over the polluted Kanduskig, Wally's, or the scabrous Paramount Lounge, where ancient whores with waxwork faces still populated most of the stools at the bar. And did he tell jokes that got the whole place laughing? Did people even approach him as he went about the job of pouring grain alcohol onto the coals of rage at the back of his brain? Not unless they wanted impromptu dental work. When my sister and nephew disappeared, them and Dunning was living in a little rented house out by the Cashman town line. He was drinking heavy. And when he drinks heavy, he exercises his fucking fists. I seen the bruises on her. And once, Mikey was black and blue all the way up his little right arm, from the wrist to the elbow. I says, sis, is he beating on you and the baby? Because if he is, I'll beat on him. She says, no. But she wouldn't look at me when she said it. She says, you stay away from him, Billy. He's strong. You are too, I know it. But you're skinny. A hard wind would blow you away. He'd hurt you. It wasn't 6 months after that when she disappeared. Took off, that's what he said. But there's a lot of woods out that side of town. Hell, once you get into Cashman, there's nothing but woods. Woods and swamp. You know what really happened, don't you? I did. Others might not believe it because Dunning was now a well-respected citizen who seemed to have controlled his drinking a long time ago. Also, because he had charm to spare. But I had inside information, didn't I? I think he snapped. I think he came home drunk, and she said the wrong thing, Maybe something completely innocuous.
Innocuous what?
I peered through the hedge into the backyard. Beyond it, a woman passed the kitchen window and was gone. In Casa Dunning, dinner was served. Would they be having dessert? Jell-O with Dream Whip, Ritz cracker pie? I thought not. Who needs dessert on Halloween night? What I'm saying is that he killed them. Isn't that what you think?
Yeah.
He looked both taken aback and suspicious. I think obsessives always look that way when they hear the things that have kept them up long nights, not just articulated, but corroborated.
It has to be a trick, they think.
Only this was no trick, and it certainly wasn't a treat. I said, Dunning was what, 22? Whole life ahead of him. He must have been thinking, well, I did an awful thing here, but I can clean it up. We're out in the woods, nearest neighbors a mile away. Were they a mile away, Turkett?
At least,
he said it grudgingly. One hand was massaging the base of his throat. The bayonet had sagged. Grabbing it with my right hand would have been simple, and grabbing the revolver out of his belt with the other wouldn't have been out of the question, but I didn't want to. I thought the bug would take care of Mr. Bill Turkett. I really thought it would be that simple. You see how easy it is to forget the obduracy of the past? So he took the bodies out in the woods and buried them and said they'd run off. There couldn't have been much of an investigation. Turkett turned his head and spat. He come from a good old dairy family. Mine come down from the St. John Valley in a rusty old pickup truck when I was 10 and Clara was 8. Just en parlay trash. What do you think? I thought it was another case of dairy being dairy, that's what I thought. And while I understood Turkett's love and sympathized with his loss, he was talking about an old crime. It was the one that was scheduled to happen in less than 2 hours that concerned me. You set me up with Fratty, didn't you? This was now obvious, but still disappointing. I thought the guy was just being friendly, passing on a little local gossip over beer and lobster pickings. Wrong. Pal of yours? Turkett smiled, but it looked more like a grimace. Me? Friends with a rich kike pawnbroker? That's a laugh. You want to hear a little story? I took another peek at my watch and saw I still had some time to spare. While Turkett was talking, that old stomach virus would be hard at work. The first time he'd been over to puke, I intended to pounce.
Why not?
Me, Dunning, and Chaz Fratty are all the same age. 42. You believe that?
Sure.
But Turkett, who'd lived hard and was now getting sick, little as he wanted to admit it, looked 10 years older than either of them.
When we was all seniors at the old Consolidated, I was assistant manager of the football team. Tiger Bill, they called me. Ain't that cute? I tried out for the team when I was a freshman, and then again when I was a sophomore. But I got cut both times. Too skinny for the line, too slow for the backfield. Story of my fucking life, mister. But I loved the game and I couldn't afford the dime to buy a ticket. My family didn't have nothing. So I took on being assistant manager. Nice name. But you know what it means?
Sure I did. In my Jake Epping life, I wasn't Mr. Real Estate, but Mr. High School, and some things don't change.
You were the water boy?
Yeah, I brought him water. And held the puke bucket if someone got sick after running laps on a hot day or took a helmet in the nuts. Also the guy who stayed late to pick up all their crud on the field and fish their shit-stained jocks off the shower room floor. He grimaced. I imagined his stomach turning into a yacht on a stormy sea. Up she goes, mateys. Then the corkscrew plunge. So one day in September or October of 34, I'm out there after practice all on my lonesome, picking up drop pads and elastic bandages and all the other stuff they used to leave behind, putting it all in my wheelie basket. And what do I see? But Chaz Fratty tear-assing across the football field, dropping his books behind him. A bunch of boys was chasing him, and... Christ, what was that? He stared around, eyes bulging in his pale face. Once again, I maybe could have grabbed the pistol and the bayonet for sure, but I didn't. His hand was rubbing his chest again. Not his stomach, but his chest. That probably should have told me something, but I had too much on my mind. His story was not the least of it. That's the curse of the reading class. We can be seduced by a good story even at the least opportune moments. Relax, Turkot. It's just kids shooting off firecrackers. Halloween, remember? I don't feel so good. Maybe you're right about that bug. If he thought he might be getting sick enough to be incapacitated, he might do something rash. Never mind the bug just now. Tell me about Fratty. He grinned. It was an unsettling expression on that pale, sweaty, stubbly face. Old Chazzy ran like hell, but they caught up with him. There was a ravine about 20 yards past the goalposts at the south end of the field, and they pushed him down into it. Would you be surprised to know that Frankie Dunning was one of them? I shook my head. They got him down in there, and they pantsed him. Then they started pushing him around and taking smacks at him. I yelled for him to quit it, and one of them looks up at me and yells, "Come on down and make us, fuckface. We'll give you double what we're giving him." So I ran for the locker room and told some of the football players that a bunch of yeggs were bullying up on a kid and maybe they wanted to put a stop to it. Well, they didn't give a shit about who was getting bullied and who wasn't, but those guys were always up for a fight. They run on out, some of them not wearing nothing but their underwear. And you want to know something really funny, Amberson? Sure. I took another quick look at my watch, almost 7:15 now. In the Dunning house, Doris would be doing the dishes and maybe listening to Huntley Brinkley on the television. You late for something? Turkot asked. Got a fucking train to catch? You were going to tell me something funny? Oh, yeah. They was singing the school song. How do you like that? In my mind's eye, I could see 8 or 10 beefy, half-dressed boys churning across the field, eager to do a little post-practice hitting, and singing "Hail, Derry Tigers, We Hold Your Banner High." It was sort of funny. Turkot saw my grin and answered with one of his own. It was strained, but genuine. The footballies baffed a couple of those guys around pretty good. Not Frankie Dunning, though. That yellow belly saw they was going to be outnumbered and ran into the woods. Chazzy was laying on the ground holding his arm. It was broke. Could have been a lot worse, though. They would have put him in the hospital. One of the footballies looks at him laying there and kind of toes at him, the way you might toe a cow patty you almost stepped in, and he says, "We ran all the way out here to save a Jew boy's bacon?" And a bunch of them laughed because it was kind of a joke, you see. Jew boy? Bacon? He peered at me through clumps of his brill cream shiny hair. "I get it," I said. "Ah, who gives a fuck?" another of them says. "I got to kick some ass, and that's good enough for me." They went on back, and I helped old Chaz up the ravine. I even walked home with him because I thought he might faint or something. I was scared Frankie and his friends might come back. He was too, but I stuck with them. Fuck if I know just why. You should have seen the house he lived in, the fucking palace. That hawk shop business must really pay. When we got there, he thanked me. Meant it, too. He was just about bawling. I says, "Don't mention it. I just didn't like seeing 6-on-1. Which was true. But you know what they say about Jews. They never forget a debt or a favor. Which you called in to find out what I was doing. I had a pretty good idea what you were doing, chum. I just wanted to make sure. Chaz told me to leave it alone. He said he thought you were a nice guy, but when it comes to Frankie Dunning, I don't leave it alone. Nobody messes with Frankie Dunning but me. He's mine." He winced and went back to rubbing his chest, and this time the penny dropped. "Turkot, is it your stomach?" "Nah. Chest feels all tight." That didn't sound good. And the thought that went through my mind was, now he's in the nylon stocking too. Sit down before you fall down. I started toward him. He pulled the gun. The skin between my nipples where the bullet would go began to itch madly. I could have disarmed him, I thought. I really could have, but no, I had to hear the story. I had to know. You sit down, brother. Unlax, as they say in the funny pages. If you're having a heart attack, I ain't having no fucking heart attack. Now sit down. I sat and looked up at him as he leaned against the garage. His lips had gone a bluish shade I did not associate with good health. What do you want with him? Turkett asked. That's what I want to know. That's what I gotta know before I can decide what to do with you. I thought carefully about how to answer this, as if my life depended on it. Maybe it did. I didn't think Turkett had outright murder in him, no matter what he thought, or Frank Dunning would have been planted next to his parents a long time ago. But Turkett had my gun, and he was a sick man. He might pull the trigger by accident. Whatever force there was that wanted things to stay the same might even help him do it. If I told him just the right way, leaving out the crazy stuff, in other words, he might believe it, because of what he believed already, what he knew in his heart. He's going to do it again. He started to ask what I meant, then didn't have to. His eyes widened. You mean, huh? He looked toward the hedge. Until then, I hadn't been sure he knew what was beyond it. Not just her. One of the kids, too? Not one, all. He's out drinking right now, Turkett, working himself into another of his blind rages. You know all about those, don't you? Only this time there won't be any covering up afterward. He doesn't care, either. This has been building ever since his last binge, when Doris finally got tired of being knocked around. She showed him the door. Did you know that? Everybody knows. He's living in a rooming house over on Charity. He's been trying to get back into her good graces, but the charming act doesn't work on her anymore. She wants a divorce. And since he finally understands he can't talk her out of it, he's going to give her one with a hammer. Then he's going to divorce his kids the same way. He frowned at me, bayonet in one hand, gun in the other. A hard wind would blow you away, his sister had told him all those years ago. But I didn't think it would take much more than a breeze tonight. How could you know that? I don't have time to explain, but I know all right. I'm here to stop it. So give me back my gun and let me do it. For your sister. For your nephew. And because I think down deep you're a pretty nice guy. This was bullshit, but if you're going to lay it on, my father used to say, you might as well lay it on thick. Why else would you have stopped Dunning and his friends from beating Ches Fratty half to death? He was thinking. I could almost hear the wheels turning and the cogs clicking. Then a light went on in his eyes. Perhaps it was only the last remains of the sunset, but to me it looked like the candles that would now be flickering inside of jack-o'-lanterns all over town. He began to smile. What he said next could only have come from a man who was mentally ill, or who had lived too long in Derry, or both. Gonna go after him, is he? Okay, let him. What? He pointed the .38 at me. Sit back down, Amberson. Take a load off. I reluctantly settled back. It was now past 7 p.m., and he was turning into a shadow man. Mr. Turkett, Bill, I know you don't feel good, so maybe you don't fully understand the situation. There's a woman and four little kids in there. The little girl is only 7, for God's sake. My nephew was a lot younger than that. Turkett spoke weightily. A man articulating a great truth that explains everything, and justifies it as well. I'm too sick to take him on, and you ain't got the guts. I can see that just looking at you. I thought he was wrong about that. He might have been right about Jake Epping of Lisbon Falls, but that fellow had changed. Why not let me try? What harm to you? Because even if you killed his ass, it wouldn't be enough. I just figured that out. It come to me like, he snapped his fingers, like out of thin air. You're not making sense. That's because you ain't had 20 years of seeing men like Tony and Phil Tracker treat him like king shit. 20 years of seeing women bat their eyes at him like he was Frank Sinatra. He's been driving a Pontiac while I worked my ass off in about 6 different mills for minimum wage, sucking fabric fibers down my throat until I can't hardly get up in the morning. Hand at his chest, rubbing and rubbing, his face a pale smear in the backyard gloom of 202 Weimar. Killing's too good for that cunt. Wipe! What he needs is 40 years or so in the shank, where if he drops the soap in the shower, he won't fucking dare to bend over and pick it up, where the only booze he gets will be prune squeeze. His voice dropped. And you know what else? What? I felt cold all over. When he sobers up, he'll miss him. He'll be sorry he did it. He'll wish he could take it back. Now almost whispering, a hoarse and phlegmy sound. It's how the irretrievably mad must talk to themselves late at night in places like Juniper Hill when their meds wear off. Maybe he won't regret the wife's much, but the kiddies. Sure. He laughed, then grimaced as if it hurt him. You're probably full of shit, but you know what? I hope you're not. We'll wait and see. Turkit, those kids are innocent. So was Clara. So was little Mikey. His shadow shoulders went up and down in a shrug. Fuck 'em. You don't mean that. Shut up. We'll wait. There were glow-in-the-dark hands on the watch Al had given me, and I watched with horror and resignation as the long hand moved down toward the bottom of the dial, then started up once more. 25 minutes until the start of the new adventures of Ellery Queen. Then 20. Then 15. I tried to talk to him, and he told me to shut up. He kept rubbing his chest, only stopping long enough to take his cigarettes from his breast pocket. "Oh, that's a good idea," I said. "That'll help your heart a lot. Put a sock in it." He stuck the bayonet in the gravel behind the garage and lit his cigarette with a battered Zippo. In the momentary flicker of flame, I saw sweat running down his cheeks, even though the night was chilly. His eyes seemed to have receded into their sockets, making his face look like a skull. He sucked in smoke, coughed it out. His thin body shook, but the gun remained steady, pointed at my chest. Overhead, the stars were out. It was now 10 of 8. How far along had Ellery Queen been when Dunning arrived? Harry's theme hadn't said, but I was guessing not long. There was no school tomorrow, but Doris Dunning still wouldn't want 7-year-old Ellen out much later than 10, even if she was with Tugga and Harry. 5 minutes of 8. And suddenly, an idea occurred to me. It had the clarity of undisputed truth, and I spoke it while it was still bright. You chicken shit. What? He straightened as if he'd been goosed. You heard me? I mimicked him. Nobody messes with Frankie Dunham but me. He's mine. You've been telling yourself that for 20 years, haven't you? And you haven't messed with him yet. I told you to shut up. Hell, 22. You didn't mess with him when he went after Chaz Fratty either, did you? You ran away like a little girl and got the football players. There was 6 of them. Sure, but Dunning's been on his own plenty of times since, and you haven't even put a banana peel down on the sidewalk and hoped he'd slip on it. You're a chicken shit coward, Turkit, hiding over here like a rabbit in a hole. Shut up! Telling yourself some bullshit about how seeing him in prison would be the best revenge, so you don't have to face the fact, shut up, that you're a nutless wonder who let his sister's murderer walk around free for over 20 years. I'm warning you! He cocked the revolver's hammer. I thumped the middle of my chest. Go on, do it! Everybody will hear the shot, the police will come, Dunning will see the ruckus and turn right around, and you'll be the one in Shawshank. I bet they got a mill there, too. You can work in it for a nickel an hour instead of $1.20. Only you'll like that, because you won't have to try and explain to yourself why you just stood by all those years. If your sister was alive, she'd spit on your... He thrust the gun forward, meaning to press the muzzle against my chest, and stumbled on his own damn bayonet. I batted the pistol aside with the back of my hand, and it went off. The bullet must have gone into the ground less than an inch from my leg, because a little spray of stone struck my pants. I grabbed the gun and pointed it at him, ready to shoot if he made the slightest move to grab the fallen bayonet. What he did was slump against the garage wall. Now both hands were plastered over the left side of his chest, and he was making a low gagging sound. Somewhere, not too far away, on Cosset, not Wymore, a man bellowed, "Fun's fun, you kids, but one more cherry bomb, and I'm calling the cops. A word to the wise!" I let out my breath. Turkett was letting his out as well, but in hitching gasps. The gagging sounds continued as he slid down the side of the garage and sprawled on the gravel. I took the bayonet, considered putting it in my belt, and decided I'd only gash my leg with it when I pushed through the hedge. The past, hard at work trying to stop me, I hucked it into the dark yard instead, and heard a low clunk as it hit something, maybe the side of the Your Pooch Belongs Here doghouse.
"Ambulance!"
Turkett croaked. His eyes gleamed with what might have been tears.
"Please, Amberson. Hurts bad!"
Ambulance. Good idea. And here's something hilarious. I'd been in Derry in 1958 for almost 2 months, but I still plunged my hand into my right front pants pocket, where I always kept my cell phone when I wasn't wearing a sport coat. My fingers found nothing there but some change and the keys to the Sunliner. "Sorry, Turkett, you were born in the wrong era for instant rescue."
"What?"
According to the Bulova, the new adventures of Ellery Queen was now being telecast to a waiting America. "Tough it out," I said, and shoved through the hedge, the hand not holding the gun raised to protect my eyes from the stiff, raking branches. I tripped over the sandbox in the middle of the Dunning backyard, fell full length, and found myself face to face with a blank-eyed doll wearing a tiara and nothing else. The revolver flew out of my hand. I went searching for it on my hands and knees, thinking I would never find it. This was the obdurate past's final trick, a small one compared to raging stomach flu and Bill Turkett, but a good one. Then, just as I spotted it, lying at the edge of a trapezoidal length of light thrown by the kitchen window, I heard a car coming down Cosset Street. It was moving far faster than any reasonable driver would have dared to travel on a street that was no doubt full of children wearing masks and carrying trick-or-treat bags. I knew who it was, even before it screeched to a stop. Inside 379, Doris Dunning was sitting on the couch with Troy while Ellen pranced around in her Indian princess costume, wild to get going. Troy had just told her that he would help eat the candy when she, Tugga, and Harry came back. Ellen was replying, "No, you won't. Dress up and get your own." Everybody would laugh at that, even Harry, who was in the bathroom taking a last-minute whiz, because Ellen was a real Lucille Ball who could make anybody laugh. I snatched at the gun. It slipped through my sweat-slick fingers and landed in the grass again. My shin was howling where I'd barked it on the side of the sandbox. On the other side of the house, a car door slammed and rapid footsteps rattled on concrete. I remember thinking, "Bar the door, Mom. That's not just your bad-tempered husband. That's Derry itself coming up the walk." I grabbed the gun, staggered upright, stumbled over my own stupid feet, almost went down again, found my balance, and ran for the back door. The cellar bulkhead was in my path. I detoured around it, convinced that if I put my weight on it, it would give way. The air itself seemed to have turned syrupy, as if it were also trying to slow me down. Even if it kills me, I thought, even if it kills me, and Oswald goes through with it, and millions die, even then, because this is now, this is them. The back door would be locked. I was so sure of this that I almost tumbled off the stoop when the knob turned and it swung outward. I stepped into a kitchen that still smelled of the pot roast Mrs. Dunning had cooked in her hot point. The sink was stacked with dishes. There was a gravy boat on the counter. Beside it, a platter of cold noodles. From the TV came a trembling violin soundtrack, what Christy used to call murder music. Very fitting. Lying on the counter was the rubber Frankenstein mask Tugga meant to wear when he went out trick-or-treating. Next to it was a paper swag bag with Tugga's candy, Do Not Touch, printed on the side in black crayon. In his theme, Harry had quoted his mother as saying, "Get out of here with that thing. You're not supposed to be here." What I heard her actually say as I ran across the linoleum toward the arch between the kitchen and the living room was, "Frank, what are you doing here?" Her voice began to rise. "What's that? Why have you... Get out of here!" Then she screamed. As I came through the arch, a child said, "Who are you? Why is my mom yelling? Is my daddy here?" I turned my head and saw 10-year-old Harry Dunning standing in the door of a small water closet in the far corner of the kitchen. He was dressed in buckskin and carrying his air rifle in one hand. With the other, he was pulling at his fly. Then Doris Dunning screamed again. The other two boys were yelling. There was a thud, a heavy, sickening sound, and the scream was cut off.
"No, Daddy! Don't! You're hurting her!"
Ellen shrieked. I ran through the arch and stopped there with my mouth open. Based on Harry's theme, I had always assumed that I'd have to stop a man swinging the sort of hammer guys kept in their toolboxes. That wasn't what he had. What he had was a sledgehammer with a 20-pound head, and he was handling it as if it were a toy. His sleeves were rolled up, and I could see the bulge of muscles that had been built up by 20 years of cutting meat and toting carcasses. Doris was on the living room rug. He had already broken her arm. The bone was sticking out through a rip in the sleeve of her dress and dislocated her shoulder as well, from the look. Her face was pale and dazed. She was crawling across the rug in front of the TV with her hair hanging in her face. Dunning was slinging back the hammer. This time, he'd connect with her head, crushing her skull and sending her brains flying onto the couch cushions. Ellen was a little dervish, trying to push him back out of the door.
"Stop! Daddy! Stop!"
He grabbed her by her hair and heaved her. She went reeling, feathers flying out of her headdress. She struck the rocking chair and knocked it over.
"Dunning!" I shouted. "Stop it!"
He looked at me with red, streaming eyes. He was drunk. He was crying. Snot hung from his nostrils and spit slicked his chin. His face was a cramp of rage, woe, and bewilderment.
"Who the fuck are you?"
he asked, then charged at me without waiting for an answer. I pulled the trigger of the revolver, thinking, this time it won't fire. It's a dairy gun, and it won't fire. But it did. The bullet took him in the shoulder. A red rose bloomed on his white shirt. He twisted sideways with the impact, then came on again. He raised the sledge. The bloom on his shirt spread, but he didn't seem to feel it. I pulled the trigger again. But someone jostled me just as I did, and the bullet went high and wild. It was Harry.
"Stop it, Daddy!"
His voice was shrill. "Stop or I'll shoot you!" Arthur Tugadunning was crawling toward me, toward the kitchen. Just as Harry fired his air rifle, ka-chow! Dunning brought the sledge down on Tugga's head. The boy's face was obliterated in a sheet of blood. Bone fragments and clumps of hair leaped high in the air. Droplets of blood spattered the overhead light fixture. Ellen and Mrs. Dunning were shrieking, shrieking. I caught my balance and fired a third time. This one tore off Dunning's right cheek all the way up to the ear, but it still didn't stop him. He's not human, is what I thought then, and what I still think now. All I saw in his gushing eyes and gnashing mouth, he seemed to be chewing the air rather than breathing it, was a kind of blabbering emptiness. "Who the fuck are you?" he repeated. Then, "You're trespassing." He slung the sledge back and brought it around in a whistling horizontal arc. I bent at the knees, ducking as I did it. And although the 20-pound head seemed to miss me entirely, I felt no pain, not then. A wave of heat flashed across the top of my head. The gun flew out of my hand, struck the wall, and bounced into the corner. Something warm was running down the side of my face. Did I understand he'd clipped me just enough to tear a 6-inch-long gash in my scalp, that he'd missed either knocking me unconscious or outright killing me by maybe as little as an eighth of an inch? I can't say. All of this happened in less than a minute. Maybe it was only 30 seconds. Life turns on a dime, and when it does, it turns fast. "Get out!" I shouted at Troy. "Take your sister and get out! Yell for help! Yell your head off!" Dunning swung the sledge. I jumped back, and the head buried itself in the wall, smashing laths and sending a puff of plaster into the air to join the gun smoke. The TV was still playing. Still violins, still murder music. As Dunning struggled to pull his sledge out of the wall, something flew past me. It was the Daisy air rifle. Harry had thrown it. The barrel struck Frank Dunning in his torn-open cheek, and he screamed with pain. "You little bastard! I'll kill you for that!" Troy was carrying Ellen to the door. "So that's all right," I thought. "I changed things at least that much." But before he could get her out, someone first filled the door and then came stumbling in, knocking Troy Dunning and the little girl to the floor. I barely had time to see this because Frank had pulled the sledge free and was coming for me. I backed up, shoving Harry into the kitchen with one hand. "Out the back door, son, fast. I'll hold him off until you..." Frank Dunning shrieked and stiffened. All at once, something was poking out through his chest. It was like a magic trick. The thing was so coated with blood, it took a second for me to realize what it was. The point of a bayonet. "That's for my sister, you fuck!" Bill Turkett rasped. "That's for Clara." Dunning went down, feet in the living room, head in the archway between the living room and the kitchen. But not all the way down. The tip of the blade dug into the floor and held him up. One of his feet kicked a single time. Then he was still. He looked like he'd died trying to do a push-up. Everyone was screaming. The air stank of gun smoke, plaster, and blood. Doris was lurching crookedly toward her dead son, with her hair hanging in her face. I didn't want her to see that. Tugga's head had been split open all the way down to the jaw, but there was no way I could stop her. "I'll do better next time, Mrs. Dunning," I croaked. "That's a promise!" There was blood all over my face. I had to wipe it out of my left eye in order to see on that side. Since I was still conscious, I thought I wasn't hurt too badly, and I knew that scalp wounds bleed like a bitch. But I was a mess, and if there was ever going to be a next time, I had to get out of here this time, unseen and in a hurry. But I had to talk to Turkett before I left, or at least try. He had collapsed against the wall by Dunning's splayed feet. He was holding his chest and gasping. His face was corpse-white except for his lips, now as purple as those of a kid who'd been gobbling huckleberries. I reached for his hand. He grasped it with panicky tightness, but there was a tiny glint of humor in his eyes. "Who's the chicken shit now, Ambison?"
"Not you," I said. "You're a hero."
"Yeah," he wheezed. "Just toss the fucking medal in my coffin."
Doris was cradling her dead son. Behind her, Troy was walking in circles, with Ellen's head pressed tight against his chest. He didn't look toward us, didn't seem to realize we were there. The little girl was wailing.
"You'll be okay," I said, as if I knew. "Now listen, because this is important. Forget my name."
"And what name? You never gave it."
"Right.
And you know my car?"
"Ford."
He was losing his voice, but his eyes were still fixed on mine.
"Nice one. Convert. Y-block engine. 54 or 5. "You never saw it."
"That's the most important thing of all, Turkett. I need it to get downstate tonight, and I'll have to take the turnpike most of the way because I don't know any of the other roads. If I can get down to central Maine, I'll be free and clear. Do you understand what I'm telling you?"
"Never saw your car," he said, then winced. "Oh, fuck, don't that hurt?"
I put my fingers on his stubbly, prickly throat and felt his pulse. It was rapid and wildly uneven. In the distance, I could hear wailing sirens.
"You did the right thing."
His eyes rolled.
"Almost didn't. I don't know what I was thinking of. I must have been crazy. Listen, buddy, if they do run you down, don't tell them what I... you know, what I..."
"I never would." "You took care of him, Turkett. He was a mad dog, and you put him down.
Your sister would be proud."
He smiled and closed his eyes. I went into the bathroom, grabbed a towel, soaked it in the basin, and scrubbed my bloody face. I tossed the towel in the tub, grabbed two more, and stepped out into the kitchen. The boy who had brought me here was standing on the faded linoleum by the stove and watching me. Although it had probably been 6 years since he'd sucked his thumb, he was sucking it now. His eyes were wide and solemn, swimming with tears. Freckles of blood spattered his cheeks and brow. Here was a boy who had just experienced something that would no doubt traumatize him. But he was also a boy who would never grow up to become Hop-Toad Harry or to write a theme that would make me cry.
"Who are you, mister?" he asked.
"Nobody." I walked past him to the door. He deserved more than that, though. The sirens were closer now, but I turned back.
"Your good angel," I said.
Then I slipped out the back door and into Halloween night of 1958. I walked up Wymore to Witcham, saw flashing blue lights heading for Cosset Street, and kept on walking. Two blocks further into the residential district, I turned right on Girard Avenue. People were standing out on the sidewalks, turned toward the sound of the sirens.
"Mister, do you know what happened?"
a man asked me. He was holding the hand of a sneaker-wearing Snow White.
"I heard kids setting off cherry bombs," I said. "Maybe they started a fire."
I kept walking and made sure to keep the left side of my face away from him, because there was a streetlight nearby, and my scalp was still oozing blood. Four blocks down, I turned back toward Witcham. This far south of Cosset, Witcham Street was dark and quiet. All the available police cars were probably now at the scene.
Good.
I had almost reached the corner of Grove and Witcham when my knees turned to rubber. I looked around, saw no trick-or-treaters, and sat down on the curb. I couldn't afford to stop, but I had to. I'd thrown up everything in my stomach. I hadn't had anything to eat all day except for one lousy candy bar, and couldn't remember if I'd even managed to get all of that down before Turkett jumped me, and I'd just been through
A violent interlude in which I had been wounded. How badly, I still didn't know. It was either stop now and let my body regroup or pass out on the sidewalk. I put my head between my knees and drew a series of deep, slow breaths, as I'd learned in the Red Cross course I'd taken to get a lifeguard certification back in college. At first, I kept seeing Tugga Dunning's head as it exploded under the smashing downward force of the hammer, and that made the faintness worse. Then I thought of Harry, who had been splashed with his brother's blood but was otherwise unhurt, and Ellen, who wasn't deep in a coma from which she would never emerge, and Troy, and Doris. Her badly broken arm might hurt her for the rest of her life, but at least she was going to have a life. "I did it, Al," I whispered. But what had I done in 2011? What had I done to 2011? Those were questions that still had to be answered. If something terrible had happened because of the butterfly effect, I could always go back and erase it. Unless, in changing the course of the Dunning family's lives, I had somehow changed the course of Al Templeton's as well. Suppose the diner was no longer where I'd left it. Suppose it turned out he'd never moved it from Auburn, or never opened a diner at all. It didn't seem likely, but here I was, sitting on a 1958 curb with blood oozing out of my 1958 haircut. And how likely was that? I rose to my feet, staggered, then got moving. To my right, down Wycham Street, I could see the flash and strobe of blue lights. A crowd had gathered on the corner of Cosset, but their backs were to me. The church where I'd left my car was just across the street. The Sunliner was alone in the parking lot now, but it looked okay. No Halloween pranksters had let the air out of my tires. Then I saw a yellow square under one of the windshield wipers. My thoughts flashed to the yellow-card man, and my gut tightened. I snatched it, then exhaled a sigh of relief when I read what was written there. "Join your friends and neighbors for worship this Sunday at 9 a.m. Newcomers always welcome. Remember, life is the question. Jesus is the answer." I thought hard drugs were the answer, and I could sure use some right now, I muttered, and unlocked the driver's door. I thought of the paper bag I'd left behind the garage of the house on Wymore Lane. The cops investigating the area were apt to discover it. Inside, they'd find a few candy bars, a mostly empty bottle of Kaopectate, and a stack of what amounted to adult diapers. I wondered what they'd make of that, but not too much. By the time I reached the turnpike, my head was aching fiercely. But even if this hadn't been before the era of 24-hour convenience stores, I'm not sure I would have dared to stop. My shirt was stiff with drying blood on the left-hand side. At least I'd remembered to fill the gas tank. Once I tried exploring the gash on my head with the tips of my fingers and was rewarded with a blaze of pain that persuaded me not to make a second attempt. I did stop at the rest area outside of Augusta. By then it was past 10 o'clock and the place was deserted. I turned on the dome light and checked my pupils in the rearview mirror. They looked the same size, which was a relief. There was a snacks vending machine outside the men's privy where 10 cents bought me a cream-stuffed chocolate whoopie pie. I gobbled it as I drove, and my headache abated somewhat. It was after midnight when I got to Lisbon Falls. Main Street was dark, but both the Warumbo and U.S. gypsum mills were running full tilt, huffing and chuffing, throwing their stinks into the air and spilling their acid wastes into the river. The clusters of shining lights made them look like spaceships. I parked the Sunliner outside the Kennebec Fruit, where it would stay until someone peeked inside and saw the spots of blood on the seat, driver's door, and steering wheel. Then the police would be called. I supposed they'd dust the Ford for fingerprints. It was possible they'd match prints found on a certain 38 police special at a murder scene in Derry. The name George Amberson might emerge in Derry and then down here in the falls. But if the rabbit hole was still where I'd left it, George was going to leave no trail to follow, and the fingerprints belonged to a man who wasn't going to be born for another